This is the EWN Podcast Network.
Welcome to Change, Redefining Success, the podcast designed to inspire you and give you actionable information to enhance, uplevel, reimagine, and reinvent your life and your livelihood. No matter where you started, where you are now, or where you've been, you too can lead an authentic, first-class life. Each week, new stories of turning points and transformation will help you define what success means to you so you can live your best life on your terms. Now here's your host, first-class life mentor and certified Profiting from Your Passions coach, Kate Fessler.
Welcome to Change, Redefining Success. I'm your host, Kate Fessler, and today my guest is Debbie Carlson Gould. Debbie spent the first 18 years of her working life at the same job. Self-limiting beliefs about her education, abilities, and worth kept her stuck in an unsatisfying situation. Driven by the desire to relocate her family and therefore increase her earnings potential, she embarked on an intensive journey of self-discovery and career development. Through that process, she defined her own motivated skill sets, came to understand what type of work for which she was most suited, and learned successfully how to bypass standard HR procedures when seeking and landing new employment within her career goals. She quickly became an expert at landing newly created problem-solving positions, serving the unique needs of the organizations that engaged her. All this led Debbie to form her own consulting firm so she could work for multiple organizations at once. Her ambitions to grow the business resulted in her devoting longer hours and creating additional stress for herself. Soon her life became unmanageable. Troublesome health issues entered the picture. Sadly, the painful and baffling symptoms were given a name: cancer. Being practically a workaholic by that time, Debbie found it difficult to face that she would need to slow down and focus on herself. Several surgeries and chemotherapy made that inevitable. The intense suffering and pain from the surgeries and chemotherapy forced a halt. Deep introspection followed, along with a rearrangement of priorities and a new definition of the meaning of life. Upon receiving her diagnosis, Debbie decided to write a blog as a cathartic and therapeutic exercise. It was also her hope that others would benefit from reading and knowing that they are not alone in facing difficulty and scary experiences. After she completed her treatment, amid positive feedback and encouragement, she made the decision to expand her blog into a book and embark on a speaking tour to share her experiences, thoughts, and feelings, again hoping to help others understand and feel supported, to offer support to other cancer patients and their families, to help others understand the real fear and existential crises faced by those fighting for their lives, to share and spread the notion that life holds so much more meaning than working, increasing earnings, getting the new house, car, and all of that. Debbie believes that love and genuine connection with others, a healthy spirit, body, and soul, are the real rewards of a life well lived. Welcome, Debbie.
Thanks, Kate. I'm so happy to be with you today.
You spent 18 years at the same job. Sounds like it was pretty unfulfilling. What type of job was that? What kept you there so long? And more importantly, how did you decide it was finally time to make a change?
Oh, wow. That seems like two or three lifetimes ago. But I started working at an acute care hospital in Modesto, California, when I was just 18 years old. And at that time, I was so young, I hadn't graduated from high school yet, I didn't have a college degree, so it was kind of a job that was directed in my path by my family. They saw I was a little bit rudderless and sent me to take some classes at the hospital to learn how to read cardiac EKG monitors. So I took that class, and I passed it, and the hospital hired me, and so I started working night shift in the coronary care units and the intensive care units, monitoring, you know, critically ill patients, their heartbeats. And I was only 18, and I was terrified. But it was something I knew how to do. I eventually, you know, was transferred into another unit that was less critical. But at that time, I was monitoring 36 different heart monitors for 36 different patients at the same time. Got on day shift, and found that I was really good at that. I was one of the best people there at that hospital doing that. I ended up training people. And so I was getting some satisfaction out of it. And so for a while, it seemed like the perfect thing for me. But after a while, I got married and had my daughter. And I started to feel less and less satisfied in that role, struggled a lot, tried to go to junior college to kind of, get educated. I thought I would be a teacher at one point, and so I was taking classes to become a teacher, but trying to work full-time and go to school and raise my daughter, et cetera, was really mm-hmm. difficult, and I found that I wasn't able to complete college. And so I was a little bit demoralized by that and just felt like I was stuck, like this is the only thing I know how to do. I don't have an education. I don't have a college degree. I'm just kind of stuck here. And also, as my daughter got a little bit older, she was preschool age, 5 years old, starting kindergarten, I realized that where we were living, the city that we lived in, the neighborhood that we lived in, was not the best place to raise a child. And I had been relocated as a teenager from Manhattan Beach, California, to the Central Valley of California, and hated it and hated it and hated it and never felt like home. And as my daughter was growing and I saw that I didn't want her to grow up someplace that I thought was awful, that I needed to make a change and needed to move out of the area. So that was that kind of spurred me on. The desire to provide a better life for my daughter.
Yeah. So is it just the one daughter?
Yep. I just have the one daughter. So at that point in time, and for a couple of years, my dad, who was already living up in the Seattle area at that time, my parents had gotten divorced and he'd remarried and relocated up here. And over the subsequent years of him moving, a bunch of my other family had moved up into this area, and I thought, well, this is, and I'd been visiting every year, and I thought, well, this is the place I want to be. So my dad at that time was working for one of the top career consulting agencies in the world, and he had been prodding me for years, like, why are you still doing this job? What is this holding you back? Why don't you do something different? And I kept saying, Dad, I don't have a college degree. I can't do anything else. I don't have any other skills. And he said, that's BS. Yes, you do. You just don't know what they are. So finally, I said, okay, help me. And what he did for me was led me through this process that they offered to their high-end executive clients at his career consulting agency. And at that time, was probably valued at $5,000 to $10,000a package of services. This was the early 90s. So it was a pretty intensive process, and it was more than just helping you find a job. It was really deep and actually has changed my life forever in a terrific way, taught me a lot of skills. So part of the process was taking personality profiles, making assessments of your existing skill sets, other kinds of characteristics about you. It involved making a list of your top 15 all-time greatest achievements of your life starting at age 10. And so, at that point in time, I was feeling like I didn't have any achievements, really. So I had to find sort of alternative, non-traditional achievements in my life that weren't connected to career or anything that we think of when someone says, list your top 10 achievements. It was things like making Thanksgiving dinner for the first time and having to organize and figure it out and time out all the foods. I mean, it was those kind of things that I was able to share. But through that process, putting all that information together helps the client and helped me see that I had a ton of skill sets, a ton of natural abilities, a ton of characteristics that were transferable and super useful and super valuable in the workplace. Things I didn't realize, even though I had been doing this job, the same job for 18 years and excelled at it and was training others, I still didn't see myself as smart or capable or accomplished in any way. And so I was really holding myself back. And this process that I did with my dad in the career consulting process that they use, I called it the Haldane way because the name of the organization was Haldane, really changed the way that I saw myself and gave me the confidence and kind of a platform off of which to jump into seeking another kind of career, another kind of job.
Yeah, that's very interesting because that a lot of that I take my clients through in my Profiting from Your Passions and Outside the Job Box career consulting. Because, yes, you're absolutely right. People often think of only career achievements when or career skills, but everybody has some special skill that they are so, so good at that it's so easy for them that they just don't think about it, but that's usually something that they could do for other people that they could get paid for. And it's always that sort of aha moment, right? Sort of like you had, like, hey, I really do have something to offer here.
Yeah. Yeah. And so at that point in time, so I discovered, you know, my value. And the other part of the service that my dad shared with me was sort of going around all the standard, typical, regular, usual ways people get jobs, you know, looking in the paper. At that time, we still read newspapers right. And all the jobs were listed in the newspaper. So, you know, what he taught me and what I learned was that, you know, if you look in the paper and let's say, you know, out of the hundreds of jobs listed there, there's 10 that you think that, you know, you go, oh, I could do that. And you send your resume in or your application or whatever, you're just one of possibly hundreds of others applying for that same position. And so the odds are kind of against you unless you're like a superstar of some kind. But at that time, I wasn't a superstar. I was just starting this new sort of career path of mine, which was sort of promotions and marketing and communications oriented, which I still do today, actually. So what I learned was this method of getting to the decision maker at the company, getting into the office of the CEO or the, you know, executive director or the manager or whatever without having to do the whole HR routine that everybody thinks they need to do. And that was super enlightening as well because I was like, oh, you know, at that time I'd just been doing that same old job forever and anybody that was at a C level, you know, in any company organization was like, oh my God, these are special humans, you know, they are right. They're to be feared and revered and that kind of thing. And they're not, they're just people, right? So what I learned was to do this thing that's just called informational interviews or informational meetings. I'm sure you're familiar with this as well, but I wasn't at the time, and still lots of people aren't. So in the context of me wanting to relocate from where we were living to where I wanted to live, I needed to start getting these meetings with people who were leaders in King and Snohomish County, which is the area that I knew that I wanted to live in, but I didn't know where to start. And so the process is you get this meeting with somebody and you are not looking for a job. I'm just here. I'm just doing research. I want to change my career role, or I'm planning on relocating and I'm looking for people to just ask questions for and get advice from. And so you take the pressure off that person you're meeting with that they have to find a job for you or that you're asking them for something, and they love to help. They're flattered when you ask for help. So the way, this is kind of a funny story, the way that I got the first meeting, because I didn't know anybody up here. I mean, my dad was living here, but he was so removed from what it was that I wanted to do in Snohomish County that I was talking to my aunt. And at that time, she was living on her sailboat in the Everett Marina and just happened in the slip next to her boat was the boat that belonged to a city council person, City Council person. And he was the president of the council at that time. And so she said to me, hey, do you think that just by me knowing him and having our boats together in a slip is enough for you to get a toe in the door to meet with him? And I said, I don't know, but I'll give it a try. So I wrote a letter to Dale Pope, that was his name, and said, hi, you don't know me. I was just talking with my aunt. Her boat's name is whatever. I couldn't remember what it is, but, you know, it's in the slip next to yours in the Everett Marina. We were just talking about my upcoming move, and I was asking her about what opportunities and sharing with her my challenges of how do I get, you know, how do I meet people? How do I figure out even a year in advance, you know, where I want to land when I get there? And she suggested that I meet with you, that you might be able to answer some of my questions. And I'm not asking for a job. I'm just wanting to talk to you and maybe get some ideas from you where else to look for information about where my skills and abilities and interests might best fit and serve the community. So I wrote that letter and at the end said, I will call you in 1 week to arrange a mutually beneficial time for a meeting. So I did that. So I called his office. His secretary answered. I said, I'm Debbie. I'm calling to follow up on this letter I sent. And she said, oh, yes, I have your letter right here. And he has asked me to give you a call to set up this meeting. What? Oh, my God. I was over the moon. I couldn't believe it. It was so cool. It worked. Oh, my God. I don't know this guy. And he's just barely knows my aunt. But for some reason, that tickled him. So he wanted to meet with me. So I planned on a 20-minute meeting. I told him it would be a 20-minute meeting. And so I actually had to fly up from California to do this meeting. And it was awesome. He spent 90 minutes with me. And we talked and we laughed and he shared with me what was happening in the community, was thrilled with my ideas and my skills and me personally. And so at the end of the meeting, what I learned from my dad and what I did was ask him. So, hey, thank you so much for meeting with me. Can you think of anybody else that I should meet with to ask these same kind of questions? And I'm not asking for a job. I'm just trying to figure out where I need to land. Is there somebody you can recommend that you would feel comfortable with me using your name as a reference? And he said, sure. And he gave me a list of 20 names.
Wow, 20.
Yes. It was more than I had could even have hoped would happen. So I took that list and I went home and I started writing letters because that's what we did back then. There was no email yet or barely email. And I did the same thing over and over and over again. And I was flying from California to Washington about every 6 to 8 weeks doing these informational interviews. So the concept is that by talking with all these people who are decision makers in their organization. So I was talking with the executive director of the United Way and the YMCA and different things. I was thinking I wanted to, you know, be in community building or nonprofit field to help, you know, improve quality of life in the community in which I was going to live. That was my goal. And so eventually with all these meetings, the concept is that you are going to be the solution to somebody's problem that they have, and they're going to offer you a job on the spot without having to go through HR, without having to submit an application, et cetera. They're going to see you and meet you and say, wow, you are the person that we need to solve this problem that we have in our organization. And eventually, that did happen for me. Mm. I met with the executive director of the Little Red Schoolhouse in Linwood, Washington. At that time, they were doing early childhood education and therapy for kids, little tiny kids ages 0 to 3 with developmental delays and disabilities. And we talked, and I told her what I was all about. And she said, oh my gosh, we need somebody like you in our organization. But I don't think we can afford you. And I said, because I at that point in time I didn't even really know what it was I should ask. You know, what is an appropriate compensation? Because I hadn't done anything else than what I had been doing in California, right? So, and she said, let me think about that. And I said, well, whatever happens, I'm going to be in this community in 2003, that's our plan, is to move here, and I bet we'll run into each other and maybe work on a project together. So I'm sure I'll see you again. And say, I'm doing all these meetings. The next time I come up for my next round of meetings, could I call you and we could just have lunch together? And she said, sure. So go home, do-do-do-do-do. I don't remember by that time how many times I'd flown up already to do these meetings. But when I called her prior to my next trip and said, hey, remember we talked and we were going to have lunch? And she said, yes, and in fact, I have a proposition for you. So bam, we had lunch. She offered me a part-time position, which was enough because I was able to telecommute from my job that I was doing in Modesto at that time. And
oh,
it was
nice.
The first job that I got up here and was able to move my family, which was awesome. And so that whole process of just talking to people and not being afraid of the sea level people
mm-hmm.
sort of changed my life and gave me control and a sense of power over what was happening to me, that, you know, that I wasn't, and we all aren't, at the whim of someone else to make your life what you want it to be. I was seeing that I could actually carve my own path, and that was the beginning of that realization for me, which was huge.
That is awesome. That is great advice for people. Yeah. Don't be afraid of them, and go out and find out the information that you need and meet with people, and something will come out of it, even if it's just that you make some really good contacts or friends along the way.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you eventually formed your own consulting firm, and it sounds like you were pretty successful, maybe a little too successful. You say that your life became unmanageable. What was that like for you?
Well, so after the Little Red Schoolhouse, I had a couple other jobs in the area. That wasn't really the best fit, turned out. And then a couple others after that were not the best fit. And I had learned my lesson in my other job of sticking somewhere for so long and not being happy. And since I understood how to move forward now, I didn't stay long in places that weren't a good fit. And what happened next was I was contacted by someone I had met networking years ago for something completely different, and they were looking for, she was on the board of directors for the Historic Downtown Snohomish Association, and said, we've been looking for someone for 9 months. We haven't been able to find anybody. I don't even know if this is what you do, but would you look at the job description, et cetera, and see if this is something that you're interested in? So I started working for them as an independent contractor, and it was great. But it was part-time hours, and a few months after that, the Snohomish Festival of Pumpkins Board of Directors, which is a kind of an association.
The Snohomish Festival of Pumpkins?
Yeah, so the Snohomish Festival of Pumpkins is an association
awesome.
Of seven pumpkin farmers in the Snohomish area that kind of threw all their hats in a ring and said, hey, how do we promote Snohomish as the place to go to get pumpkins, like in the whole Western Washington? This is where you should come. We're all here. There's six of us, plenty to choose from. And so they started this association years before they connected with me, but they had lost their program manager or their event manager, and they were looking for someone else. And someone in Snohomish that I had been working with, and I still to this day don't know who it is, referred me to them, and I'd only been working in Snohomish for a few months, and already someone was referring me to say, this person's awesome. And
awesome. You must be very, very good at what you do.
I guess so. So then I was like, okay, so now I've got these two clients, right? Well, what's to say I couldn't get other clients like this, you know, and do, so what they were contracting me to do was develop their advertising, plan and produce some events for them, do some fundraising work, both of those organizations. And I was thinking, well, I can do that for other organizations too. I have these graphic design skills. I know how to write marketing copy. I can do Facebook. I can do websites, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, I'm going to make this big, you know. And so I set my goal to just keep building my business and building my business. Well, even though I hired an assistant to help me with some of the more administrative secretarial type tasks, I was still I got to a point where I was working 12 hours a day, almost every day. And I felt at that time that it was going to be worth it because in the end, I was going to have this great business. I was going to be making more money. I was going to be successful. I was going to have a lot of influence in my community, et cetera. But at the end of a couple of years of trying to, you know, grow my business, I looked at how much money, extra money I was making and how, when I looked at, has the quality of my life changed at all? And it had changed, but not for the better.
Mm-hmm.
I was super stressed out, but that was okay with me. Like, I started to live to work, and my whole identity and self-worth became tied to my work achievements and how much I could do in the community and how perfectly I could do all of the things that needed to be done. And that became, it consumed me. Recently, I've just recently sort of purged my office, my home office. And when I started doing that, I hadn't looked at it for a couple of years because of my illness, but when I came in just a month ago to purge out my office, I came inside and I looked and I saw how full it was of file cabinets and shelving units and piles of papers and all the supplies for the events I was doing, and there was no room for me. It was like literally I was trapping myself in all this stuff around my work, and I didn't realize it so much when it was happening. I was just crazy. I couldn't manage my life. Like, my whole life was about work, and my relationships suffered, relationships with my family and my health, my mental health and my physical health.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. You were having some health issues. Were you worried, or did you just write it off as a result of the stress of running a super busy consulting company?
Well, I kind of felt that. This was a few years ago when I started to get symptoms, and I was just having these wretched periods, just incomprehensible amounts of bloating and blood and pain, and which had sort of increased over a period of time, and then they just got to be where I was home for a week. I couldn't work for a week because it was that bad. But I would get through. I was like, oh, it's perimenopause. I'm just going through menopause. Everybody experiences this. I'm not special. I just have to endure this until I go through menopause, and then I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. So I'd have these weeks of just agony and inability to work or do anything. But for some reason, I wasn't paying attention. Like, I was just like, I just got to get through this so I can get back to work, so I can, you know, fulfill my obligations to my clients, etc. And that was my primary concern. Like, this is such an inconvenience for my work. I don't know. I was nuts. I was nuts. And so then finally, I said, okay, I got to go in to see a doctor and see what's happening with me. And maybe they'll just give me, you know, some meds or some kind of treatments that will just lessen the pain or, you know, sort of lessen these symptoms that I'm having that everyone has, right? Well, so my doctor, you know, did a pelvic exam, and she said, I think there's something there. We need to do an ultrasound. And so the ultrasound revealed that I had a very large cyst on my left ovary. And I was like, wow, what? And of course they wanted to do surgery to remove it. And I said, nah, nope, I don't have time for that. What else can we do?
Yeah,
I don't have time for this. Who has time for this? No, what else can we do that's not surgery? Well, we can give you hormone therapy because sometimes hormones will shrink an ovarian cyst. And that sounded reasonable to me because 10 years before I had had an ovarian cyst and we treated it with hormones and it kind of shrank. So I said, okay, yeah, let's do that. I had a DNC and they put an IUD in, one of the kinds that, you know, exudes hormones of some kind. And so my terrible period symptoms went away, and we thought probably this hormones would help shrink the ovary. And so you need to come in for a follow-up ultrasound in 3 months so we can check on the size of this ovary. Well, so I neglected to go in for the follow-up when I was supposed to because I was so busy working. So I didn't actually get to the second ultrasound until after the holiday season, because that's a really busy time for me. And I went in to have it because I was having some pressure and pain again. I was like, what's going on? Uh-oh, that's right. I was supposed to go get this ultrasound. And so what we discovered was that the cyst, instead of shrinking, had doubled in size. Really scary. I needed to have surgery for sure. And a complete hysterectomy is what was recommended, given my prior health history and the fact that, well, if we just remove this ovary, doesn't mean you wouldn't get, you know, a cyst on the other ovary, so let's just do it all now. We'll take care of your menopause, et cetera, et cetera. And I was thinking, okay, we'll do that. So this is where it gets kind of heinous. I had a hysterectomy, and while they had me on the table, the surgeon, you know, saw the cyst. It was a 13-centimeter cyst, which is about the size of a grapefruit.
And wow, that's big.
It's big. And so they said, while we're in here, we're going to send your ovary to pathology to see what's in there, to see if there's anything that we need to worry about. So they did that, and they saw the initial test that they do in the pathology lab right there instantly showed there was some questionable activity, some questionable cells, some questionable growth inside the ovary. And so then they said, okay, they told me before the surgery, if we find something like that, we're going to do this tissue sampling all inside of your abdomen to make sure that there aren't any other areas of potential cancer growth or tumor growth in your abdomen. So they took little samples of different lymph nodes and other parts of inside my abdomen after the surgery. And then typically after that kind of major abdominal surgery, they irrigate out your abdominal cavity with saline, and then they collect all that fluid and spin it down in the lab and look for whatever's in there. So they did that, and the results I got 12 days after the surgery were that, yes, this thing in your ovary was a cancerous tumor. No, none of the other tissue samples that we took show any active tumor growth. But we did find quite a few random floating cancer cells in this fluid that we took out of your abdomen. And the type of cancer cells that they were, which is called clear cell carcinoma, is such a rare and aggressive form of cancer that they said, we recommend that you have chemotherapy, even though you don't have any active tumor growth, because these guys are super aggressive and they very often will, you know, form their little club and get together and start growing new tumors if we don't knock them out right away.
So, well, that must have not been a very pleasant experience for you. How did you feel in that moment when you received that diagnosis, you know, cancer, something nobody wants to hear? And then, of course, you didn't even think you had time for the surgery, much less the treatment, which, I don't know, you tell me, was it long and involved? It sounds like, I mean, I've known people who've gone through chemo, and some is short and relatively painless, and others is long and drawn out and has, you know, severe side effects. What was that like for you?
Yeah, so there's a two parts to your question. I'm going to answer, give you two parts of, you know, two answers to it. When I actually, at the doctor's office, when he gave us that news about the clear cell carcinoma, I was actually quite calm because I kind of already knew in my head and in my heart that I had cancer. And I had already been thinking about it. And so when I actually, it was confirmed for me, I felt kind of calm in that moment, but then had to do a ton of soul searching and thinking for weeks after that. I wasn't sure about having chemotherapy. What they had recommended to me is what they call a dose-dense program, which is having very high doses of chemotherapy every week, which is not normal. Most people get their chemo and then they have 2 to 3 weeks in between so that their body can recover and they can get stronger and be ready for the next dose. But for me and for this particular type of cancer, they said, if we give you time to rest, we also give the cancer time to regroup. And so this is what we recommend. And you're fairly young and healthy. You know, we think you can, your body can handle it. And so that's what we did. And it was really rough. There was a lot of the physical symptoms that we all know about, the nausea and the fatigue and the pain. But for me, in addition, and I came to discover it's the same for others, there was also a lot of emotional and spiritual agony around the process. And for me, being so, my self-esteem and my self-image being so tied to my work and my extrovertedness in the world, I wasn't able to manifest any of those things that I was so accustomed to doing and being in the world, like being and being needing to be perfect at all of it. I had to let go of that idea of who I was because I couldn't do all that stuff before. I was a person who was loath to ask for help, even if I was struggling, even if I was stressed, because I can do it way better than everyone else, and I'm superwoman, and I'm independent, da 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 da. And so those were things I just had to let go of, and I had to learn how to be a different way in the world. I had to learn how to ask for and receive care and assistance, and that was quite a transformation for me. And I had a lot of angst and a lot of emotional pain around this identity crisis. And for me, that was all happening at the same time that my body was physically fighting and feeling in agony, and so that was really hard. Some really wonderful things also came out of that time. And some of those wonderful things that came out was that I did learn how to receive love. I was able to deepen my relationships with my loved ones in my life. I had many, many, many people sort of come out of the woodwork to offer their support and assistance in the form of giving me rides to my chemotherapy treatments, in the form of bringing me and my family, prepared meals so that we could, so that my family could focus on taking care of me and not worrying about, cooking and making sure that we were all eating healthy. People, I got so many cards and so many phone calls and texts and support from people in the Snohomish community that sort of wrapped themselves around me that I didn't really realize were there, and that I didn't realize that there were so many people that cared about me, and that there were people out there that I had neglected that had made overtures to me, friendship overtures to me over the years that I sort of didn't take seriously because I had this lack of self-esteem. And it was a revelation to me that here are all these people and wow, they value me, they care about me. And it was this sort of outpouring of love and support that really buoyed me up and helped me fight and gave me the strength that I needed to face my fears, to face this identity crisis that I had, and help transform me into understanding better that I was going down the wrong track, that I was worshiping a false god of achievement and money and influence and those kind of things. And they're really not that important, you know, once you are facing, you know, death. It's definitely a hard way to learn those kind of life lessons. But
indeed.
I did learn.
You started writing a blog with a great name, by the way, Not Gonna Sugarcoat It. Mostly for yourself, but also, as you've said, hopefully an inspiration to others who might be going through the same thing. What made you decide to do that?
I'm not sure exactly. It seems like I was, at the time I decided to do it, I was still caught up in this idea that, you know, I needed to be of service, you know, like that I still needed to be extroverting myself out into the world, that if I completely withdrew from everything, that somehow I wouldn't be serving my true character and my purpose in life. So, but at the same time, I thought, well, if I do this, I might be able to help people because no one talks about this. When I started telling people that I had cancer, which it was really hard for me to do that, I kind of kept secret the other health. When I first started having the health issues, I kept a secret from everyone except for my very close family, because even though I had surgery the year before I found out I had cancer and I was down for a while, I didn't want any of my clients to think I couldn't fulfill, you know, my obligations to them. So I kept a secret. I went back to work as soon as I could, which probably was to my detriment, etc. But then when I got the diagnosis and I said, you know what, I'm going to do the opposite this time. I'm just going to put it all out there, and it's going to help me to get out what I'm feeling and what I'm experiencing, but it also might help other people who are going through cancer or maybe just other difficult circumstances. And keeping all of that, their agony and their fears and their questions inside of themselves because they're afraid that other people won't understand what they're going through. You know, if I could share what I was going through and some of the really dark, mucky, dirty things that I was thinking and feeling and experiencing, maybe I could help those people. So that's what I did.
And now you're going to turn it into a book. Same name as the blog?
I think so. When I started to clear out my office, I have this giant 4x5 whiteboard in there. I wiped it all down and I started making notes of all the things I wanted to do, because that's how I am. I can't help it. I realized I have probably 5 books in me. So one of them will be Not Gonna Sugarcoat It. And that's the one that'll be based on my blog. I got so much positive feedback from not just cancer patients who started following my blog and friends and family, which really were the first people that started following it. And it was kind of also a way for me to keep everybody up to date on my progress without having to talk to every single person. So it's kind of a cool tool in that way. But then I found that people who I didn't know also then started to follow my blog and follow the Facebook. And I got a ton of positive feedback and encouragement from folks who said, you know, this smells like a book deal in the making, and your writing is so inspirational. And there's people who contacted me who said, you know, my aunt had cancer, but she was a woman of so few words. We never knew what was going on with her. And your blog has let us, given us a peek, a window into what she might have been feeling and experiencing. And so that was really beneficial to, you know, the family members and caregivers of folks who are experiencing serious illness. So when I decided to write the book, I felt like maybe it's a little too me-ish to write a book just about me. So still there's some of that weird self-esteem stuff going on there, low self-esteem stuff from way back when. So I thought, okay, so what I'll do is, here's what I'll do. I will interview other women that I admire who have gone through some terrifying or very challenging circumstances and came out of it. And so I'll interview them and I'll use those stories in my book as well. So that's the process that I'm in right now, is I have a list of people that that I'm interviewing for the book. So it'll be my story, but also other people's stories. And what I'm discovering as I'm talking to people is that their stories are, there's a lot of similarities between the way the different people are sort of dealing with their challenges. And I guess that sort of would have been an obvious thing that I should have thought of before I started interviewing people, but I guess I really didn't think of it. And so it's actually helping me. The process of talking to other people is actually helping me process and deal with my own feelings and my own situation as well. So it's kind of an interesting process I'm going through.
Yeah, and I'm sure that'll be very helpful to other people because, number one, we need to know we're not alone, right? And see others' experience so that we can feel as if it's, you know, it's doable.
It is doable.
So we're almost out of time. I have to ask you, what is one book or resource that changed your life besides your own that you would recommend to people?
Gosh, Kate, I've read so many books in my life. I'm not sure that I can point to a single one that's changed me or that's influenced me. I really have enjoyed the writings of John Maxwell. You're probably familiar with him. He's a leadership coach. And right now I'm reading Brené Brown, Rising Strong, I think is her latest book that came out. She's a shame researcher, and her Rising Strong book is about, you know, coming out of a difficult situation and how to bounce back from that. It's about resiliency, and that's what I really would like my Not Going to Sugarcoat It book to be about, resiliency and people, you know, understand what that means and what that looks like and that it's achievable, you know, for anyone. And I think that's what Brené does in her book, Rising Strong.
What would you say to someone who is at a crossroads in their life, similar to doing some soul searching, maybe because of a health crisis or some other crisis, rethinking how they're defining success for themselves?
Sorry, there was a little disturbance in the audio there. I didn't hear your question.
Oh, I'm sorry. What would you say to someone who's at a crossroads in their life, either because of a health crisis or, you know, and just questioning where they are and where they're going? They're rethinking how they're defining success for themselves.
Mm-hmm. One of the practices that I adopted when I got my diagnosis was daily meditation, and that has really helped me. And also, this is going to sound really funny, but therapy. Like, I started seeing a therapist, and I've been meditating, and I think, you know, the meditation takes you in to your actual real core voice, allows you to actually listen to what your own heart is telling you, and then the therapy is you know, the external, someone outside of you helping to guide you through the questions that will lead you to the answers that you're looking for, that maybe you don't know what those questions are yet. And a therapist can help you ask those questions.
Excellent. And if people want to learn more about you and maybe read your blog, where can they find that?
That would be notgonnasugarcoat.com. And I'm also on Facebook, and that's facebook.com/notgonnasugarcoat.
Excellent. Debbie Carlson Gould, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's such a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thank you, Kate. It was my great pleasure as well.
How amazing is she, Debbie Carlson Gould? When you're faced with a life-changing event, whether it's a health crisis or something else, it can be an opportunity to really enhance and up-level your experience. My intention with all of the interviews in this podcast is that whatever challenge you're facing, you're inspired by what you hear and realize that you are not alone. And if they can do it, you can too. If you have something to say about this or any of my other shows, please leave a comment on the show page or on my Facebook page, First Class Life Solutions. You can find links to the recommended resources and previous podcasts on my website, firstclasslifesolutions.com. If you'd like to be a guest on my show, please click on the link on the show page and fill out the survey so we can see if it's a good fit. And lastly, please follow the show and tell your friends. Next week, it will be just me, and I'll be talking about fear. What's holding you back, and what can you do to get past it? Until then, here's to your authentic first-class life. I'm Kate Fessler. Thanks for listening to Change, Redefining Success.
I'm Sandra Yancey, CEO and founder of eWomen Network. We invite you to listen to all of our EWN podcast hosts at ewnpodcastnetwork.com.